Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
By popular demand, we're bringing somebody back, Patrick Bontemps, who used to be the head of the Medical Pediatric Digestive Diseases Department at Queen Fabiola's Hospital for Sick Children in Brussels, but who now is... Patrick, give me the full weight of that new title that you've acquired.
I'm now the head of the Interventional Pediatrics. So they create this new unit, finally, unifying everything that makes intervention procedure, like bronchoscopy, cardiac catheterism, and all digestive procedures. So it's called Interventional Pediatrics, cardiology, pneumology, and digestive disorders.
Well, that's an amazing remit, an amazing set of things to be responsible for. And I must admit, my thoughts go at this moment to the nurses who have to take care of every possible kind of patient in a high-intensity care setting. One day it's a bronchoscopy, the next day it's a transurethral resection of a bladder tumor, but it's all in the day's work for them and for you. However, your first love is still pediatric endoscopy and pediatric interventional endoscopy. And it's with that in mind that you're going to be telling us today about kind of an update on pediatric tube placement, gastric tube placement, how it works, and sometimes what happens when it doesn't.
So maybe we can start with situations where it's needed, finally.
Sure.
So we use tube feeding, and there are different kind of tube feeding indeed, when for a child it's unsafe to swallow, for example, because of the risk of bronchial aspiration, when he cannot have a sufficient oral intake to maintain hydration and nutrition. It is sometimes also needed when there is an increased need for intake, like cystic fibrosis, for example. And sometimes also children cannot be left fasting, for example, in some metabolic disorders. Mm-hmm. So they need to be fed also when they sleep.
The glycogen storage disorders, for example. Yeah.
Exactly. So then we need to use tube feeding. And tube feeding, the easiest solution, of course, is putting a tube in the nose, and a nasogastric tube. It's a procedure that can be done bedside in 5 or 10 seconds maximum. It's easily done by doctors or nurses. You don't need specially trained people, finally. And so in emergency, it's very effective and efficient. And I must say, it's sometimes interesting also to use first nasogastric tube feeding in a child who is severely malnourished.
Mm-hmm.
Before you do more aggressive procedure, because then the recovery will be easier, and the risk linked to the anesthesiologist will be lower.
So building the child up before something that is going to knock the child down.
Absolutely. And it's also, it's really prevent complications to gastric tube feeding, gastrostomy.
Well, you distinguish in a paper that you've given us. Let me see if I can pull that paper up. Oh, my. Here we go.
I think I sent you the last guidelines we updated.
Complications of percutaneous and surgical gastrostomy placements in children, a single center series from your home institution. What prompted you to pull this together? What was the rationale for collecting these data?
Thank you for the question. So we thought at some point it was interesting to have our own evaluation of the complications we had with the procedures. Because there are some publications, but mostly they are opposing percutaneous placement and surgical placement. So finally, it's the common fight between the pediatricians and the surgeons, and some of the surgeons wants to be the best, and the gastroenterologist wants to be the best.
Well, so the surgeons are doomed. The surgeons really are doomed to failure. We know that,
of course.
Okay.
I cannot say anything about surgeon anymore because my daughter became a surgeon.
Patrick, I'm here for you and I offer my sympathy.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Okay, so back we go to before I started to give you a hard time. And the question is again, you put this together to have a single center compilation without it necessarily being biased from the point of view of the surgeons who want to show off, and from the point of view of the pediatric gastroenterologists who are clothed in the full armor of righteousness. So what did you find?
We find a higher rate of infection than we thought, in fact, because usually we don't have a lot of very immediate complication. So for that, we are quite happy because severe bleeding or severe infections, meaning sepsis, in the first or the second day of the placement is, of course, really terrible. But then if you skip this immediate part, sometimes you don't have a good figures of what is happening later. And this is why it was important for us to collect all the complications early, in the middle time, means after 1 week and 1 month, and later complications.
So when did the unsuspectedly large number of infectious complications crop out? In the medium term or in the long term?
Yeah, between the 10 and 30 days after the placement, finally.
Well, tell us what led to that. What, looking backward, what changes in protocol management have you introduced to reduce that number of complications?
We have a more careful look, not only when placement and a few days later, but we are finally changing dressing more frequently and really look more carefully for starts of infection, of local infection. And we treat locally then, not with general antibiotics, but with local antibiotics or disinfection earlier in the follow-up.
That's interesting. Was there any difference in this increased rate of infection between surgically placed and endoscopically placed tubes?
There is a small difference, but I think it's not really the main point, finally, because we have infections in both situations. So it's more interesting, as you said, what can be changed in the protocol, surgical or not surgical, on how we follow patients, finally.
Closer attention to the wound.
Closer attention, okay. Absolutely. But now we solved also these questions with the surgeons because most of the time we work together. So I train the surgeons to do percutaneous placement and they don't want to do surgery anymore. Because surgery is much longer, finally, and more complicated. And now that they test the percutaneous placement, especially the push technique, so the one-step technique, they don't want to change anymore. So even
just
when they do
fundoplication,
they use the percutaneous placement for the gastrostomy just after.
I am astonished. You've taken the bread out of your daughter's mouth.
I can train her too.
Okay. and she in turn will be placing gastrostomy tubes rather than grasping for the scalpel. What else did you find?
And another thing that was really interesting, finally, that instead of asking the surgeon to do the gastrostomy by themselves, we worked all together. So sometimes we use six hands, two for the visualization of the endoscopic visualization, finally, the inside of the stomach. We ask the surgeon to look in the peritoneus cavity. Mm-hmm. And eventually they can use devices just to move the colon or put the stomach in a nicer place. So percutaneous placement is possible. And then the last hands, of course, are putting the gastrostomy.
I imagine that if a patient has undergone previous surgery, had a previous bout of peritonitis, that she's no longer the best candidate for endoscopic placement.
Still, the child is. Just if you need, if you don't have a correct transillumination, finally, the placement is not correct, you have interposition, then the surgeon just move the stomach, put the stomach in a nicer place, and percutaneous placement is again possible.
And that would be done laparoscopically or with a laparotomy?
Laparoscopically.
Huh, okay, all right. I'm thinking about...
One camera in the umbilicus, one device, usually to move the stomach. And that's it.
And you at the head of the table with the endoscope and the monitoring. It sounds great. What sort of response has this paper evoked from your colleagues? Have you had any feedback from others who have read this, who have said, yes, it's like that in my institution, or no, we don't have similar findings?
It's always complicated to publish complications, especially if they are not the best results. So I think the figures are quite similar in many centers. Mm-hmm. But maybe, like us, also some places may underestimate the rate of complications if you only look to early complications and not to complications that appears a little bit later.
One always likes one's work to find resonance, not just at the institution where it was conducted, but also in the wider world. To find that you've made a difference to a larger group of potential patients. And that was the reason I asked that question as to how people are responding. So you're one of the few institutions that has presented an overall assessment of complications following gastrostomy placement.
Well, we are not the only one, of course, but I think this is quite a new way to... really evaluate in depth, finally, the problems that we had.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. It's going to be a little bit shorter podcast than I had anticipated, but have I left out anything that you would like to cover? Any points that you think are worth mentioning that I've overlooked?
I would certainly be sure that the one who are listening to us really understand that gastrostomy placement is really require a multidisciplinary approach.
Right.
So indication is really important because the procedure in itself is one aspect, but of course bringing patients and parents to accept gastrostomy and being able to take care of the child after the placement is something really important.
And, you know, I have forgotten something to mention that I think is worth mentioning, and that is to lay a little bit of weight on the idea that you want the patient to be in as good condition as possible, not only for future work, but at the time of the gastrostomy placement, because the complications that you've recorded were more frequent in the undernourished. So how do you build up somebody who needs gastrostomy to undergo the gastrostomy? Tube feedings?
Tube feedings is one approach, indeed. Nasogastric tube is one approach, because then at least the family is familiar with pump, with the rhythm, with how to clean, and they have products at home, so it will be easier after the gastrostomy placement.
I got that. Okay.
I always tell them also that the day we will put the gastrostomy will be not be a nice day for them. They will feel quite sad and feel they didn't succeed something. It's true also for doctors sometimes, the neurologists, at least in my institutions, when we put the gastrostomy, they feel it's like they failed something because the child is not able finally to feed himself completely. So I always say at short time, you will feel a bit sad, but on the long term, you will see all the advantages of not being obliged to try to force the child to swallow something, not being worried about the child being accepted, I think, to take some medications or some water when it's too hot outside, some foods sometimes. So they can really concentrate on the pleasure that the child can have by mouth, and not on the necessity, and not on obligation, finally. Only pleasure.
I take your point, and I think it's a very good one. Thank you for making the time to come and speak with us today. And I do wonder, you had a chance some while ago to share with us a song, and you don't get to share the same song twice. That's a rule. What have you picked out for today?
Well, I think the world is not doing very better than the last time we talked together, Alex. So certainly for those who like old songs, I would say the best would be to listen to Jacques Brel. Quand on a que l'amour. Uh-huh. And it finished by saying that when we, with only love, we can win the world. But maybe some people who are listening to us are quite young and will not be happy to listen to Jacques Brel. So there is a rock band. Some of them are Belgian. And the title I will choose is To Win the World by Buggy.
Thank you.
If you would like to listen to the song, check out our Spotify playlist, Espigan's Favorite Songs.
Thank you for taking part in the Espigan podcast series. We've really enjoyed having you here.